Isaiah chapter 11, verses 1 through 9. There shall come forth a shoot from the stump of Jesse, and a branch from his roots shall bear fruit. And the Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and might, the Spirit of knowledge and fear of the Lord. And his delight shall be in the fear of the Lord. He shall not judge by what his eyes see, or decide disputes by what his ears hear. But with righteousness he shall judge the poor, and decide with equity for the meek of the earth. He shall strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he shall kill the wicked. Righteousness shall be the belt of his waist, and faithfulness the belt of his loins. The wolf shall dwell with the lamb, and the leopard shall lie down with the young goat, and the calf and the lion and the fattened calf together, and a little child shall lead them. The cow and the bear shall graze their young, shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like the ox. The nursing child shall play over the hole of the cobra, and the weaned child shall put his hand on the adder's den. They shall not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. This is the word of the Lord. I wanted to start this morning by sharing a little bit about myself. One of my greatest fears with coming to Fairview was almost realized during the last hymn. Gary had to leave a little bit early, and so he asked if I would lead the hymn, and I'm really scared that at some point you all are going to hear my singing voice. I have a friend who's a pastor in Williamsburg, and they wanted to give the people who were working in the nursery the ability to hear the sermon, and so they would leave his mic on, and they would pipe it through to the nursery, and one time they forgot to turn it off during the hymn. So the nursery workers, they didn't hear the organ, they didn't hear the choir, they didn't hear the congregation, they just heard my friend singing a cappella. Someone came up to him after the service and they said, "Travis, please stop. You are brutalizing us with your singing voice." And that's a fear, that's a concern I have, that one day someone will come up to me afterwards and say, "You brutalized us with your singing voice." See, I have absolutely no musical ability. We had our staff Christmas lunch this week, and we were sharing about who could play which instruments, and I told them that as a little kid, my mom told me that she wanted me to take piano lessons, and I wanted to get a guitar, and so she had a compromise that she would get me a guitar as long as I took piano lessons, and so I was learning both, but then my little brother sat down on my guitar and broke it. And so we duct taped it back together, and I kept on taking piano and guitar, and then he sat on it again, and then I quit piano and guitar, and now I have no musical ability. See, but I love music. I love it as much as you can love something that you have no skill in. And last week, Jenny pointed out that I didn't really explain why we were talking about the carols with the sermons. And so some of you might be like, "Well, Tim is trying to convince us to love the carols." Some of you might have heard me singing and you're thinking Tim is trying to make up for brutalizing us with his voice. But the real reason that we're studying the carols is that they are drawn from these beautiful Advent texts that show us what we are waiting for, to describe what we are hoping for with Christmas. Last week we talked about Isaiah 9 and the carol, "Once in Royal David's City," to learn that this new hope comes from David. This week we're looking at "Lo, How a Rose Ere Blooming," the hymn we just sang, and Isaiah 11. See, Isaiah is instrumental to our understanding of Advent because we have these prophecies like last week and this week where that Jesus is related to David, that he comes from Jesse. But Isaiah also prophesied about the end of the house of David. He said in verse 7 that the house of David would fail. It's kind of, it's fairly confusing. It's almost like saying that the 76ers are going to fail miserably, but also they're going to win gloriously. It doesn't make sense. How can one house fail but also provide salvation? See, the people of Israel had grown disillusioned with the house of David. they'd experienced many failures, including the lack of faith in King Ahaz in chapter 7. They were not looking for another king in the line of David. They felt like they knew that story. This is why in chapter 11, our text today, we read that the coming rose, the coming branch, the coming king will not be another king in the line of David, but in fact goes back to David's father, Jesse. It will be a new and different type of king. Isaiah is using comparative language. He's saying that the coming king will be so much better and so different from the kings that the people had experienced before. Today, obviously we don't have kings, but we do have presidents, we do have politicians and celebrities and CEOs. We have individuals who we put our trust in. I'm sure that each of you at one point has been disappointed by the failures of a politician, a company, an employer, a pastor, a family member whom you trusted. Isaiah promises that this coming king will be better and different than the kings of Israel, who the people of God were used to, and will be better than the kings of our day, who we're used to. Today I want to look at, first, how this king will be more qualified than other kings. Second, how this king is different than other kings. And finally, how this king is coming again. First, this king is qualified. When I was in college, I ran a ministry at William & Mary called the Fellowship of Christian Athletes. So we would bring in different speakers each week, and a lot of our best speakers were friends of mine who were a few years older, and something would happen when they would decide to go to seminary, and then they would come back and preach while in seminary. They got a lot worse, because what happened is they would be studying Greek and Hebrew, and they would be in the weeds of learning, and then they would come back, and they would want to show how much they learned, and so they would make this, their whole point would be the chiastic structure of the chapter and the present perfect tense, and then everyone's eyes would glaze over. But there are some real advantages to learning the original languages. One of my mentors used to say that they make you learn to read in Greek and Hebrew so that you have to read it slowly. This week I was reading it slowly, and there were a couple of interesting things right at the beginning of our text. In verse 1, we read that a shoot comes from the stump and a branch from the roots. In English, these sounded pretty similar to me. I kind of found them repetitious. They're both things growing out in a plant form. But in Hebrew, there are actually a couple of huge differences I wanted to point out. First, shoot and branch are two different words. Hoter for shoot and netzer for branch, both of them mean branch, but they have very different connotations. So the first one, hoter, it's usually used to describe a rod for punishment, while netzer is always associated with new life, new blooms, new fruit. So basically, Isaiah is saying that this branch is both the branch that your dad tells you to go outside and cut down when you've misbehaved, as well as the branch that produces new fruit and new blooms. The new king, Jesus, will be able to punish the failure of the house of David as well as fulfill God's promises from it. See, how is that possible? The second interesting part about verse 1 is that the netzer, this word, comes from his roots. I'm not a very good gardener or grower of things. In fact, I'm constantly forgetting to water the plant that's in my office right now. In fact, I'm pretty sure it's past the bend. But the interesting thing is that this flower, this bloom, it's not growing off of the branches or even the stem, but it's growing up out of the roots. Scholars have had a really hard time figuring out what this means. They call it the root sprout. So he's somehow the root and the sprout. Somehow this coming king is both an ancestor and a descendant to Jesse and David. It was before and after. How does that work? Because Jesus was present at the creation of the world and will be present again at the end of the world. This is one of the reasons why this king will be more qualified than the kings that we're used to. The main qualification, though, for this coming king comes from verse 2. In the resting place of the Spirit of the Lord. Isaiah writes, "And the Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the spirit of counsel and might, the spirit of knowledge and fear of the Lord. Occasionally, the spirit of the Lord is found often in the Old Testament. Sometimes it's used to talk about, it's given to a specific individual for a specific task. In Exodus 31, it goes to this man named Bezalel, who's building something important to the Lord, and so he gives them the spirit of the Lord, which actually is just like amazing ability as an architect and contractor. But normally, we're talking about a permanent indwelling of the Spirit, close to what happens here with Moses and Joshua and David. There are six aspects to the Spirit: the wisdom and the understanding, which refers to the intellectual life, the counsel and might, the physical life, and the knowledge of fear of the Lord, the king's relationship with God. See, this king, Jesus, is the resting place of the Spirit, which manifests in wisdom, understanding, counsel, might, knowledge of God, and fear of the Lord. And it rests so beyond human capabilities. See, the people were used to kings who were born into the right family, kings who were promised by God, who occasionally would demonstrate wisdom or some other positive attributes, but now they were promised a king with all of the attributes. Jesus was a special sort of king, and his connection with the Spirit qualified him to be a better and different king than the people of God were used to or prepared for. We read about the fulfillment of this prophecy when Jesus is baptized. In the words of Matthew, when Jesus was baptized, immediately he went up from the water, heavens were opened to him, and he saw the Spirit of God descending like a dove and coming to rest on him. And behold, a voice from heaven said, "This is my Son, with whom I am well pleased." Can you imagine a more amazing coronation? This is the fulfillment of Isaiah's prophecy that Jesus is the Son of God, on whom the Spirit of God rests. He is the only king with these qualifications. No one else, no president, no monarch, no politician, no doctor, no pastor, can measure up to the coming king, the branch, Jesus. This king has better qualifications. Our second point is how this king is different. This section starts in verse 3 of our text, where it says, "He shall not judge by what the eyes see, or decide disputes by what his ears hear." I mentioned earlier that David was said to have the Spirit of the Lord rest upon him. We can read about that in 1 Samuel 16. This verse also has an allusion to that, because Samuel was very impressed with the physical nature of David's older brothers. Do you all remember this? David's older brothers were tall and strapping, and Samuel was like, well, they look like they could do the Lord's work. But God told Samuel, "Do not consider his appearance or his height, for I have rejected him. The Lord does not look at things the way people look at. People look at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart." This is radically different than the way we operate today. We judge people by how they look, how they dress, what car they drive. That's how we are with other people. Before they say a word, we think we know where they are from, what their driving motivations are, whether or not they could be helpful to us. In the same way, most kings or governments care about those with wealth, with intelligence, with might, with skills, or possessions that could aid the government, we also seek out people based on earthly qualifications, and we seek to distance ourselves from those who seem different. It happens in the church, too. I remember one of my mentors told me that no one would take me seriously if I didn't have leather-bottomed dress shoes. He thought that rubber-bottomed dress shoes were cheap, and that real business people would not respect people with rubber-bottomed dress shoes, and so you'd be in a meeting and he would just look at the bottom of your shoes. But Jesus, the coming king, does not look at us in terms of power or ability or money or dress shoes. Next, we read how Jesus will deal with the least of these. "With righteousness he shall judge the poor and decide with equity for the meek of the earth. And he shall strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he shall kill the wicked. This king will be especially concerned for the poor, the meek, and will bring justice to those who prey upon them. You know, throughout the Bible, Jesus shows himself to be uniquely concerned with the poor, the sick, the stranger, those whom society treats as less than. John Calvin talks about how Jesus is the king who protects and guards the poor instead of the rich. I actually really like the way that Calvin talks about this, because I think this is difficult for us as a white church in America who is much wealthier than the vast majority of the world. We tend to want to think about this in terms of spiritual poverty instead of actual poverty. But what Calvin and Isaiah and Jesus do is they're talking about both. They're talking about the literal poor, but they're also talking about the spiritual poverty, which in the words of John Calvin says, is to have no lofty views, but to be truly humbled by a conviction of our poverty and nakedness so as to depend on Christ alone. See, both spiritual poverty and actual poverty are about dependence. See, how is this difficult from the kings of our lives? See, the earthly kings of our lives, the kings of politics, they want our money, our time, our vote. The earthly kings of culture and media, they want attention, Facebook likes, and Twitter follows. The earthly kings of career want time, ambition, and talent. See, the earthly kings want to depend on you. They want to siphon things away from you. Christ is a king who wants you to depend on him, who wants to provide you things like justice and righteousness. Verse 5 talks about how fundamental righteousness and faithfulness are. It says that Jesus wears righteousness and faithfulness as belts or garments because they are so central to who he is. Jesus did not come wearing royal purple. He did not come wearing a crown. He did not come wearing a three-piece suit with leather-bottomed dress shoes. He came wearing righteousness and faithfulness because he is a king we can depend on, a king we can count on. Third, this king will come again. So Jesus brings righteousness and faithfulness. And what we read in verses 1 through 5 should sound sort of familiar to us, right? We've seen a lot of this fulfilled in the life of Jesus. We've heard about this stuff in the Gospels and in the church. Jesus fundamentally changed the world and changed our lives when he was born on Christmas Day. But it's why we're singing carols and celebrating the season and decorating our trees. But in verse 6, we see something a little bit different. We start to see these strange prophecies about the animal kingdom. What's going on here? See, Isaiah is speaking of this fundamental change in the animal kingdom. He's speaking of an idyllic peace, a return to how things were at creation in the Garden of Eden. In verse 6, when the wolf dwells with the Lord, and the leopard lies down with the young goat, these are predators having to rely on their normal prey for security. Alec Motyer is a scholar who I like, who spent a lot of his life focused on Isaiah. He describes verse 6 as a reconciliation of old hostilities and the allaying of old fears, while verse 7 is a fundamental change of nature in the animals themselves, eating the same food with the herbivoral nature of all creatures pointing to Eden restored. So all the animals get along. They're eating the same food. They're lying down with their enemies, and a child shall lead them. A child is responsible for these changes. And many of Israel's leaders throughout the Bible were trying to save the people of God in one way or another. Moses brought the people out of Egypt. Joshua brought the people out of the desert. The judges and some of the kings tried to bring the people out of captivity. The human kings and leaders were trying to restore Israel to a better state, to the state they were with Abraham, to the land of milk and honey, or to the Israel of King David. But Isaiah is arguing that Jesus will return God's people not to any of those half measures, but will return them fully to the Garden of Eden. Verse 8 says that the nursing child shall play over the hole of the cobra, and the weaned child shall put his hands on the adder's den, over the adder's den. See, this is a baby playing with a snake. And I think this is a really beautiful verse that I find very significant, because it takes us back to Genesis 3, when God kicked Adam and Eve out of the garden, right? God kicks Adam and Eve out of the Garden of Eden, and then he punishes Adam and Eve and the serpent, and he says that your offspring will have enmity for ages, right? There will be enmity between the snakes and the people. But what Isaiah is saying is that the reign of Jesus will bring an end even to that, even to the results of man's original sin. But here's the thing, I would not recommend anyone to go out of church today and then to put their hand in the den of a snake. I did not recommend that. I am not liable if you end up getting bitten by a snake today, because this has not happened yet, right? This is a reality, this is a hope that we have not fully realized. You know, we look around today and we still see brokenness in this world. We still deal with cancer and sickness. We still see broken marriages and relationships. We still lose children and spouses. We still feel depression and despair, because Jesus has not yet returned us to Eden. See, Christians live in an already but not yet reality, in that we are already experiencing some of the aspects of Jesus' kingdom, but the full glory of that kingdom has not yet been realized. This is why Advent is so important for us. We are waiting on the full glory of God's kingdom. I was talking to someone this week with some medical concerns, who had done a lot of research about what they thought were going to happen, the medical advances of the next 10 years, and how that might change our reality and really provide some hope. Well, the second coming of Jesus, the full glory of God's kingdom, is a similar but much larger hope than that of medical advancements. We will experience an end to sickness and loss, an end to enmity between animals, and a fundamental and glorious return to the Garden of Eden. So Isaiah says, "They shall not hurt or destroy in all of my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea." Just like the people of God waited and anticipated the first coming of Jesus at Christmas, so are we an Advent people waiting on Christ to come again and usher in this full kingdom of God. So what does this mean for us? I have two quick ways that we can apply this to our lives. First, I think this means that we can depend on him, because Jesus is this different type of king who uses different metrics for what's valuable. We can depend on him and participate in his work. I've always found it a little strange that we dress up for church. You know, I understand the origin and the reason for it, but as a kid, it seemed kind of weird to me that we needed to act a certain way and kind of fake like I was more well-behaved than I was for church and for God. You know, it made me think like God was a really formal family member who knew everything about etiquette, and that's why your parents had to teach you to use the right fork and when to say whomever versus whoever. Like God was very invested in etiquette and a sterile environment. But just like God told Samuel, the Lord does not look at things people look at. People look at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at his heart. This week, I'd like to challenge everyone to incorporate this into your prayer life. Whether you pray every day or maybe you haven't prayed in years, try to reach out to God without worrying about coming up with the right words to say, without trying to sterilize your thoughts, to say what God you think God wants to hear, without covering up your concerns, without worrying about the appearance. Just go to God with what's in your heart. Second, this also means that we have a new kind of hope. One of my best friends is not a Christian. He's also smarter than pretty much all of my other friends, which is a tough combination because he asks these great questions and then the rest of us scramble to try and come up with a decent answer. I remember one year he brought up Christmas, and he said, I think Christians love these ceremonies and rituals, but I don't think that they know what they're actually celebrating or hoping for. They seem to have very different hopes. I think there's some truth in that. I think that we know that we're celebrating God coming to earth. We're celebrating the incarnation, the person of Jesus. But what are we hoping for this Advent? Are we hoping for heaven? Are we hoping that Christ in us will help us to become better people, to be better husbands and wives? Are we hoping that Christ's example might provide an ethic for the world? See, in Advent, we are not hoping for mere rituals or improved personal behavior. We're not even just hoping for heaven. We are hoping and waiting for Christ to return. Return with our loved ones. We are hoping and waiting for him to usher us into this new age and to return us to Eden. See, this reconciliation between earth and heaven is much more practical than I think we normally consider. We are waiting for an end to cancer, an end to poverty, an end to environmental concerns, an end to starvation, to jealousy, to depression, to war. In the words of today's carol, "Lo, how a rose e'er blooming," we are waiting and hoping for a flower whose fragrance tender with sweetness fills the air, dispels with glorious splendor the darkness everywhere. This is the hope we have in Advent. Hope that a different and better king will come. Hope that a rose will come from the stump of Jesse, and that will bring an end to all the darkness of our world, that will bring the kingdom of God here to earth. Isn't that a lot better than the wool socks you're hoping to unwrap on Christmas Day? Today's carol ends with the words, "From sin and death he saves us and lightens every load." This is the true hope of Christmas and what we are waiting for this Advent.